I'm not gonna lie. I'm impressed. You've got some balls breaking in here.
If you see my balls, then you'd be really impressed.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hey, you're listening to Sordid Cinema, the flagship podcast of SordidCinema.com. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Ricky D.
What's up, Simon? What's up, Internet?
We're also joined by Victor Stiff.
Hey, guys.
And we're also joined by Patrick Murphy.
Hey, how's it going? Glad you're back hosting, Simon.
Also known as the man who hates movies.
Who, me or Patrick? I guess Patrick. Both of us.
Somehow, I don't know. It's the movies we're picking, damn it.
It's a movie podcast in which the hosts don't like movies.
It's the movies that are to blame, all right? It's the movies, not us. Anyway, hooray. I'm back. Everyone's back. So this is sort of the latest chapter in our Fantasia saga, although also, you know, has broader theatrical implications for everybody. This week we're going to be talking about, a little bit belatedly for most people, we're going to be talking about David Leitch's Atomic Blonde, and then after that we're going to be talking about a movie that just hit theaters recently, was also at Fantasia. It's called Good Time, written and directed by the Safdie brothers. We'll get there soon enough. Just want to briefly mention, in terms of anticipatory notices, TIFF starts soon, as in about 2 weeks from now, and some of us are going to, screenings have basically already started and on the press side of things, so we're already amassing material. We're going to be absolutely killing it at TIFF this year. We've got several correspondents, some current, some incoming. I'm really excited about our coverage. There's so many great-looking movies hitting the fest this year. I'm hoping that they're, you know, for anyone who's been paying attention, they've kind of narrowed their focus a little bit this year. They've trimmed things back a little bit, which I think is a great move. Maybe not everyone agrees on whether what they've trimmed was the right thing to do, but I think in general, in principle, scaling back was the right move, and I'll be curious to see how that pans out for everyone this year. So do look for our TIFF coverage over the next little while. And just a quick plug, since I plugged this podcast over there, for anyone who's been watching Twin Peaks and has not yet listened to The Lodgers, which is the podcast that I do with Kate Rennebaum and a fabulous set of guests, that is, of course, winding down soon as the show is winding down. So do check that out before the end. We've got some, I literally just got done recording a really great episode with guest Byron Davies. So do check that out if you like Twin Peaks. All right, that's enough plugging for one day. Do we have anything else we want to mention before we launch into it?
Well, if our listeners would be willing to give us an iTunes review, it would be much appreciated, and we could use the help, because we had to swap our iTunes feed a while back when we rebooted the show, so we lost all 67 previous iTunes reviews. So it goes a long way in helping us find an audience.
Yes. Yeah. More reviews, more ratings. Huge for visibility. That's basically the only way you can get greater visibility on iTunes, as I understand it. So do leave a nice review, a nice rating, if you can. It, you know, we work hard to bring you this quality hashtag content, so it's the least you can do. God damn it. Anyway, without any further ado, let's hear a clip from David Leitch's Atomic Blonde.
I chose this life, and someday it's going to get me killed. But not today.
Lorraine Broughton, expert in intelligence collection and hand-to-hand combat.
Agent Gascoigne was killed last night. Did you know him?
Enough to say hello.
He had an atomic bomb of information. Find out who's hunting our operatives and trust no one.
David Persons, your contact.
Welcome to Berlin. I'm David.
Don't shoot. I've got your shoe.
Your own personal Jesus.
That was me from the moment my feet touched the ground.
This was never part of the plan.
It was part of mine.
I've lost the target.
What do you know about this woman who's been following me?
You look like you need saving.
That was a clip from Atomic Blonde, starring Charlize Theron and James McAvoy, directed by David Leitch, who you may know from the John Wick films, and written by Kurt Johnstad from a graphic novel by Sam Hart and Anthony Johnston called The Coldest City. Now, full disclosure, I have not seen Atomic Blonde, but y'all have, so I'm going to be helping to direct the conversation, but I'm going to be staying mostly out of the way. So Atomic Blonde, I mean, I think that people first noticed this movie, maybe, I feel like the trailers started to come out ages ago, really sort of forcefully pumping out this notion of Charlize Theron action star, in the wake of Mad Max. And of course, with the John Wick Association, people are really, I think we're really expecting, a top shelf high octane action film. Whether or not we get that, I suppose, is up to you. Who wants to offer sort of a brief synopsis of what the hell this movie's about?
Wait a second. Does anybody know what this movie is about?
Maybe that's the right opening question. What is this movie about?
Well, it's about a lady kicking ass. Like, in all honesty, Simon, I actually really like this movie, and I think I'm going to be the most positive, but there really isn't much of a story. And the story that we do get is somewhat confusing because there's so many characters in this movie, and by the end of the movie, like, they sort of like lay out a blueprint for what these characters are about and what they are after a specific list. But by the end of the movie, I'm not entirely sure what to believe, because it kind of feels like the movie itself betrays those characters. It's really hard to explain because we don't get to know much about these characters, and what little we do know about these characters ends up being sort of thrown out the window in the last act. It's one of those like spy movies where everyone seems to be double crossing everyone. Well, you're not entirely sure what everyone's motivation is or whose side someone's on.
We can say it's set in 1989, the end of the Cold War.
That's correct.
Okay, that's one thing.
And they're looking for a list. Like in every spy movie these days, there's a list of agents out there that everybody wants their hands on. That's basically the premise of this.
If you watch Game of Thrones, it's very similar to Arya's storyline.
Okay.
No joke. I actually kind of really like this movie, and I was a little worried going in because I had heard so many people on like Twitter. I read so many like tweets on Twitter about people complaining about the movie. And it is from the director of the very first John Wick film. And if you like the very first John Wick film, I can see you liking this movie because the action is so amazing. Like, there is this one scene. It's all done in one take. It starts within an apartment building, and Charlize Theron's character basically like kicks everyone's ass, and the camera follows her down the stairs, outside, into a car, and then you have this shot which resembles the one take from Children of Men, but it never cuts, right? And so you get the 7 to 8 minute long tracking shot following her shooting and killing everyone in sight and driving off. And it's just amazing. Like, that shot alone for me personally was worth the price of admission. It's a super stylish film, and that's what I like about it. Like, I just like, in terms of like the cinematography, the art direction, very similar to what we see in John Wick 2. I like everything from the costume designs to the camera shots to the soundtrack. At the same time, it's all sort of like problematic. Like, for example, the soundtrack is awesome. Like, you get like the greatest hits of like the 1980s. But at times it kind of feels like the music's there for no reason, and or it doesn't really play well with the scene, and it becomes somewhat distracting. So it's like, for example, there's this one scene in which she goes into a bar and you hear a song playing in the background, And then all of a sudden the song stops for no reason. You hear jazz music playing in the background. So I was like, wait a minute, is she hearing this music in her head? Like, is she listening to like a Walkman or a Discman? I'm like, why is this song playing when it's not actually playing in the club? So it's one of those movies where it is style over substance, but I still think I was incredibly entertained watching it.
It sounds like, Patrick, you may not be in this camp.
All right. So there are entertaining things about this. He's right about that action scene. That's a very, very good action scene. It did ruin itself, not ruin itself, but there are a couple annoying things in that. That car shot specifically, like you could tell where they cut because there were some continuity errors there. But the fight in the apartment is choreographed and shot very, very well. That's one of the most entertaining physical fight scenes that I've seen in a movie in a long time. It's just too bad that there was really nothing at stake because I didn't really care about who won in the end, because there's nobody really to care about in this movie whatsoever, even including Charlize Theron's character. And she handles herself as an action hero magnificently. I mean, she is definitely a physical presence, and she handles all of the action scenes with very believably. Like I can believe in the power and her movement behind all of this, but there just isn't much there other than a cold stare mm-hmm. the entire time. So there's really nothing to care about, and the plot is full of so much duplicity that it loses itself in it, and it lost me in it, and I was really trying to pay attention. So as far as the story goes, yeah, there's really not much there, and the action is very technically proficient. It's very, very nice to look at, but it's devoid of any power or meaning. But it's very cool if you like that. Like Rick said, it's style over substance. I wasn't a huge fan of the as big of a fan of the cinematography as you. I thought it was very muddy, and I know it's Berlin and it's 1989, so of course it had to be cloudy and brown and gray the entire time. But I thought with, you know, the way the neon lights kind of flash in the title screen, I was hoping for just a little more pop. You get that here and there, like when she goes into a club. Yes, you see some bright red and blues and things like that. But for the most part, it's a pretty colorless, joyless looking film. And there's a lot of scuzz involved in it. I don't know. It didn't really appeal to me. If that's what they're going for, fine. But it kind of didn't show me any side of Berlin 1989 that I hadn't seen before in other movies.
There are some beautiful moments, like the sequence in which she visits the aquarium and there's a fight sequence. And the fight sequence like is played out and there's like a long shot, and you just see the silhouettes of her kicking everyone's ass with the backdrop of the aquarium and the fish swimming in the backdrop. There's also like the club scene that you mentioned. Also, it's not just the director of John Wick and John Wick 2, but it features a lot of people who worked on those movies, including the stuntmen.
Yeah, so, and he didn't do John Wick 2, actually. He just co-directed John Wick.
Exactly. But a lot of people that worked on John Wick 1 and 2 are working on this film. So like this crew, be it like the cameraman, the cinematographer, the stuntman, the director, like they really do have a talent for creating like stunning action sequences.
Yes.
It'd be nice if they had a better screenplay. My biggest problem with this movie, Simon, is for some reason they decided to frame the movie in such a way in which at the beginning of the movie, she's basically being interrogated by John Goodman and Toby Jones. And so the entire movie flashes back to the events that unfolded prior to the interrogation. And so we keep going back to the interrogation, and it just deflates any tension and suspense within the film. Because as soon as you get to the interrogation scene, time after time after time, you get kind of like bored, and nothing happens in that interrogation scene. Like, she's basically reciting the whole entire film. Like, she's telling Toby Jones and Dan Goodman exactly what you're about to see in the next like 5 minutes. And it's such a strange, strange decision on the part of the filmmakers and screenplay writers to write it that way.
Now, it offers nothing. Those interrogation scenes offer absolutely nothing as far as driving the story forward. They're completely unnecessary.
Now, Victor, as I understand it, you experienced, shall we say, a personal setback sort of over the course of your screening.
Well, I love John Wick. I love John Wick 2. Atomic Blonde has been on my radar for a long time. I went in there pumped, ready to have a good time. I love pulpy crime noir thrillers. I love good action movies. And I fell asleep in the second act. I woke up for that phenomenal, 10-minute tracking shot at the end. But up to that point, there was something about the movie that left me cold. And I really don't get it, because I love John Wick, but it's not like he's the deepest most fleshed out, well-rounded character. I think, like the guys were saying, it's that cutting back to the interrogation. And you know, it's so cliche in a spy movie. It's just lies wrapped in lies, left in lies. You don't know what to believe. And it just kind of deflated the movie and kind of lulled me into sleep, literally.
The thing about John Wick is John Wick establishes the character within the first 5 minutes of the first movie. Someone breaks into his house. They kill his dog. He's out for revenge. That's all you need, especially if you're a dog lover and if you love Keanu Reeves. And plus, it's Keanu Reeves. He's more charismatic than Charlize Theron in an action film for whatever reason, because she's great in Mad Max. And she was also in the last Fast and Furious movie. But in this movie, they don't really give her a scene or dialogue to work with that allows her character to shine or show any personality. Like, she's just like cold.
She's stoic.
Cool. She's cool. That's the thing. Yeah. A cool person, it's hard to get a beat on what they're really thinking, right? Mm-hmm. The people we relate to the most is the person who takes a beating, the person who's afraid, the person who's trying to climb an insurmountable obstacle. She was just like a badass killing machine. And even from the beginning of the movie, when you see her getting out of that ice bath, you know she's taking a physical beating, but you don't feel the emotional beating.
And she's cool. And like, John Wick is cool too. But one thing that this movie was lacking was any kind of sense of humor. It's so dour. It's so serious. There's just absolutely nothing to sort of chuckle at any ridiculous situation. They take it so seriously still. She's incredibly stoic throughout the entire thing. She has no sense of humor. John Wick at least has a sense of humor.
There is one actor in a movie who does try to bring a sense of humor, and that is James McAvoy's character. And he actually smiles, and he's actually kind of funny, but it's few and far between. Like, there's one specific scene where after she crashes a car, he goes to pick up her shoe, her high heel shoes that she that went flying out the window, and she tries to shoot him, and he cracks a joke. I wish we had more of that humor throughout the whole entire film. Yeah. I still like this movie. Like, the problem with this movie for me, it's the kind of movie I'm never going to watch again. Like, I might watch a specific scene on YouTube, like maybe in like 5 years time, and be like, oh, I want to revisit that like 7 to 8 minute long tracking shot. And I'm sure someone's going to upload it to YouTube, but I would never watch the film from start to finish ever again.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is, you're all skipping Charlize Theron's most important action role, Aeon Flux.
I forgot about that one.
Yeah, that was actually commented on in she did a long form interview with I think Variety or the Hollywood Reporter, where they talked about how that was sort of her and her handler's sort of original attempt to be sort of like a female action star. And they also had the handy framing of Wonder Woman having just happened, so it was kind of an interesting bit of reflection there. My question is, you guys were talking about the action choreography, and sort of an interesting thing having a female action star, because often in movies that depict sort of female action heroes, they kind of, you know, oftentimes they rely on this crutch of having the woman be superpowered. And then, you know, it's no longer an issue that someone who has a smaller frame is physically smaller than her opponents, that it's believable that she's, you know, flinging them around like cardboard. So I'm wondering, does this movie, do Leech and company, do they play with her physicality in a way that makes sense in terms of exploiting that for more creative choreography?
I think they just hired like the shortest actors in Hollywood. Like, Toby Jones is the tallest person in this movie. Toby
Jones. She's tall though. Charlize is tall. She's close to 6 feet in certain, like, if she's wearing her boots there. I've actually stood next to her in real life, and I'm 6'3". She wasn't too much shorter than me in heels. So she is a tall woman. So she can be an imposing figure up against some of these men. And I think they don't go too far, Simon, I would say. I never felt that anything was totally unbelievable. And like with John Wick, she takes her beating. Like, that long fight scene is not just full of superhuman moves. So, I mean, there are moments in that fight scene where two people are just crawling on the ground taking blind swipes at each other. They get hurt, and she definitely suffers the effects of being punched or whatever, or kicked by a man. They suffer as well. Nobody's just going through insane martial arts sequences or something.
But it's also the same film where she ties a hose or a rope to herself and jumps out a window and uses another man as an anchor and cannonballs back into a lower floor of the hotel. So, yeah.
There is that too.
A grain of salt, yeah.
Dude. Toby Jones is like 4'5", okay?
He's a short guy, yeah.
They do the whole thing that they do with Tom Cruise in movies. They actually cast him alongside shorter people and or find ways to make him look taller.
But she is tall, though. She's taller than Tom Cruise naturally.
Toby Jones is taller than Tom Cruise.
I don't think they never had her stand next to Toby Jones, though. She's only sitting at the table with him. And
that's
I don't
true.
Know how
most people are pretty much the same torso length.
Yeah, they gave him a high chair for that scene.
But they had no problem making her. I think she's taller than McAvoy is.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And they had no problem putting her up against that. I mean, I don't know how short he is, to tell you the truth, but I can tell you she's got to be like 5'9", 5'10", somewhere in there.
The other thing that I just wanted to mention from the long form interview she did was that she did get injured quite a lot making this film. So she put in the time and the effort.
It shows too. The action scenes are very, very well done. They're just devoid of meaning. That's all, of any sort of soul. If they had, I will tell
demands,
you, this movie made me appreciate John Wick Chapter 2 a hell of a lot more. Now I really want, I would go watch John Wick Chapter 2 again over this. Not that it was horrible or anything. I don't want to convey that impression. Like, I didn't hate this movie either, but I just felt empty walking out of it. Like, I don't need to ever see it again either. There's just nothing there. And at the end, when the final, like, reveal has happened, it just, I don't know, it fell with a thud. That's all.
It's because she looks tired throughout the whole entire film. Like, if she actually got beat up while filming this film, like, clearly it had an impact on her performance and her body, because she looks half asleep even when she's kicking ass. Like, it's so strange. Like, you got to watch this movie. It's like beautifully shot. The action is amazing, but there's something wrong with the tone and the pace of this film, even for an action film. It's really odd.
It almost sounds like they were making a kick-ass action movie, and then, like, Jean Le Carré came in to ghost direct to, like, slow down the pace a bit.
Yeah, because they really try to focus on plot at times, and they're really trying to explain to the audience what's going on. And it just doesn't work, because none of it really matters. Going after a list for the umpteenth time in a spy movie, I mean, we've all seen it. It doesn't matter, and double crosses happen all the time, so none of this is really that important. But they're acting like it's the first time this has ever happened in a spy movie before.
It doesn't have the right pacing to be a solid thriller, and it probably needs two more action scenes to be a solid action movie. It's in this weird no man's land.
Oh, by the way, Simon, the big twist in this movie is that she calls John Goodman's character a cocksucker, and you find out at the end why. I'm not joking.
Oh. Okay.
Totally not joking.
He's right. It's
wow.
True.
Is this like how Dunkirk hinged on shitting? Is this like one of those things you don't see coming?
He won't care that it comes. That's all I could say.
All right. Well, it feels like everyone's more or less in agreement to varying degrees of enjoyment. So maybe we should be wrapping this up in favor of our next review. Is there any other burning hot topics that need to be discussed about this film before we move on? All right, I'll take that as a no. Woo!
Go see John Wick Chapter 2. That's all I could say.
Actually, one of my favorite composers, Tyler Bates, who I talk about a lot on this podcast, he did the original music. Unfortunately, his score is overpowered by the 80s soundtrack.
Okay, so that is one thing I want to talk about. The 80s soundtrack bugged me. It was so shoehorned in. They were just like, hey guys, remember the 80s? This song happened. And it never fit the scenes.
She would be in the middle of a scene, like in the middle of a scene, and a song would start playing. But it's not playing like in the background of, say, like the nightclub or the jazz bar and or in someone's car. It would just start playing magically for no reason. Like, it was so weird. Like, and the music's great. Like, I love every single song they selected. But you got to have a reason for putting the music into the movie. Like, it's just, it's odd. Like, it comes out of nowhere. And so it's so distracting.
Yeah, now, absolutely.
Do they go for like deep cuts, or is it more obvious 80s stuff?
Super obvious 80s pop. I mean, with a kind of Euro bent, though.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Atomic Blonde, the feelings are mixed. It's funny, Rick, you told me go see it, but now I don't feel jazzed to go see it.
I don't know. I was entertained watching it, but I'm not going to give it like a full positive review.
Yeah.
It has problems. Like,
I'll catch it on VOD at some point.
Exactly. It's a great movie to watch on VOD. Yep. Rent it.
On like a lazy Sunday or something.
See it for that action scene, if nothing else, because that really, it truly is spectacular, I think.
All right.
Or for the Ed Knight twist ending.
Yeah, exactly. Find out why she called him a cocksucker, Simon. You have to.
Is that his code name?
I'm not going to tell you.
Anyway, movie's called Atomic Blonde. That's our verdict. Patrick, as I understand it, you did not see Good Times, so you're going to be leaving us?
That is correct. I'll be dropping out. I haven't had enough time to see Good Time.
All right. Well, I guess we'll let you know soon enough if you made the right choice in your priorities.
Yes, I'll have to listen in for this one.
All right. Well, thank you, Patrick. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Safdie brothers and their new movie, Good Time.
Lorraine Broughton. An expert in escape and evasion. Proficient in intelligence collection.
Let's cut the crap, shall we?
And hand-to-hand combat. It's an impressive set of skills.
Talents can be overrated.
Lorraine, how well do you know James Gascoigne?
Enough to say hello.
He's dead. Find out who's hunting down our operatives. Where a lot of brave men and women are going to show up dead.
Fuck.
Your contact is David Percival.
Well, let me help you with your bags. Welcome to Berlin.
Fuck's sake.
Trust no one. Oh, bollocks.
You look like you need saving.
Next?
You're incredible, do you understand?
Yeah.
I'm serious, you think I could have done that without you standing next to me being strong? Are you feeling this? Are you feeling the I'm feeling right now?
Yeah, I'm cold.
You cold?
Yeah.
Let's get to Virginia, man.
Just keep your head now.
Turn around!
He's all right, we didn't do
anything. Whoa, whoa, get back here!
So I told you about my brother, yeah? Something happened. I don't know exactly what. He's been arrested. He's being held at Rikers Island.
Love. Oh my God, that's awful.
Make me queen.
Just gotta get him out of there before something bad happens. He could get killed in there.
The Bureau is out.
You need another 10 grand. You get another 10 grand, your brother will get out.
The truth is an act of love.
I think something very important is happening, and it's deeply connected to my purpose.
Every day I think about untwisting and untangling these strings I'm in to lead a pure life. Look ahead in a clear sky. Ain't gonna get there. But it's a nice dream. It's a nice dream.
That was a clip from Good Time, a new crime drama written and directed by, directed by Ben and Josh Safdie. And written by Josh Safdie and Ronald Bronstein, starring Robert Pattinson, Ben Safdie, and Jennifer Jason Leigh. It made quite a splash at Cannes this year. It was at Fantasia this year as well, and it's starting to hit rep theaters around the continent. It stars Robert Pattinson as a lowlife in Queens named Constantine, a.k.a. Connie Nikas, who is constantly trying to get Well, you'd think he's trying to get his mentally handicapped brother out of scrapes, but really mostly spends his time getting him into them. And predictably, when they try to rob a bank, things go south, very, very south, and things just proceed further south from there. And maybe that's all the plot summary you should get for now. Victor, I want to start with you. Have you by any chance seen any of the Safdie brothers' previous work, like Heaven Knows What, for instance?
I'm familiar with it. Heaven Knows What is one of those films that has been sitting on the back burner. Like, I need to watch this for about a year. But after watching Good Times, definitely I'm going to give it a watch right away.
So I take it you have warm feelings towards Good Time.
It is a fun time at the theater. A lot of people who dive into crime genres, they really focus on just plot. They might not be the most technically skilled filmmakers, but these guys have a level of technical skill they apply to the film. It's just an impeccably crafted film, from the editing to the cinematography, the pacing. From the minute it starts, your heart just starts racing and it doesn't let up till the end of the film, and it's really hard to do.
Ricky, I know that when you saw the film at Fantasia, you were able to see it with the filmmakers in attendance. I'm assuming it must have been a packed house, right?
It was sold out, and I just have to publicly apologize to the director, specifically Robert Pattinson, because here's what happened, Simon. So when the movie ended, basically everyone stood up and gave the movie a standing ovation, right? And I was so amazed to what I had seen. Like, I love this movie so much. And I was sitting there processing the movie. And then I was looking at Robert Pattinson because I was like 2 feet away from him because I sat like front row. So like I could have like, you know, extended my hand and actually touched a man. And so I was just sitting there staring at the guy. And then the director looked over and he looked at me and I was like the only person sitting down. Everybody was standing up, giving the movie a standing ovation. And he gave me like this funny look. Like, I felt so bad because he thought I didn't like the movie, but I love this movie. I became familiar with these directors after watching the movie. It's a movie called Lenny Cook. It's about the basketball player Lenny Cook, because I love basketball, right? So I became like a huge fan of that documentary, but I had no idea that they made these type of movies. Like, you know, like one of my favorite filmmakers of say like the past like 10 years is like Sean Baker. Mm-hmm. And I put them on the same like pedestal, like the same level as Sean Baker in terms of like their style of filmmaking, the fact that they like live in New York City, shoot in New York City mostly. Everything about Good Time is what I love about cinema. Everything from the performances to the cinematography to the soundtrack to the story to the fact that they don't actually waste any frames. Like I mean, even when the credits are rolling, there's still a story being told. Like right away when the movie opens, like the opening scene, the credits are rolling, the opening credits are rolling on top of the opening scene. And when the movie closes, the credits are rolling like during the closing scene. It's like they don't waste a single frame of their movie. Like for them, it's like a wasted space. Mm-hmm. And so they try to make most of what they can with whatever time they're given. And they somehow crafted what I think is so far the best movie of the year. And it runs only 100 minutes long. It's got this amazing screenplay. It's got some of the best scenes of any movie of 2017. It's got one of the best performances, and not by Robert Pattinson. Like, he's fantastic. But I'm talking about specifically the co-director, Josh Safdie. He's just amazing in this movie. He's not in it for very long, but he's so, so good. The opening sequence in this movie, Simon, like right away, it just had me. Like I was won over with the opening shot. The opening shot basically is like you get this like close up of his character. He plays Benny, right? That's the character's name.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while since I've seen it. So
Nick.
Benny's
Nick. Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry.
He plays Nick.
Yeah. Ben Safdie plays Nick. That's the source of the confusion.
Right. Okay. So I'm already confusing everyone's name. So. So anyways, so that opening scene in which the character Nick, who's like played by the co-director Benny, he's having like a meeting with a social worker, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the way they have like the close up on him, I don't know, just there's something about the way it was just shot and filmed. Like you can actually get a sense of Nick's trauma. Like the movie just opens up, like it's like 2 minutes into the movie and you already know so much about this character. And like, even like the fact that he sheds this tear, like it was like heartbreaking. And that's like the first 2 minutes of the movie. Like in 2 minutes, they did more to flesh out a character than most Hollywood films do in 2 hours. I love that scene. And then like, there's just something about these guys. Like, they know how to direct a movie and capture these amazing raw performances from, like, an amazing cast of professional and non-professional actors and just say so much without necessarily using dialogue. Like, it's just, there's something about these guys. They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I think what really struck me about Good Time is the unself-consciousness of it. It's, you know, so many, especially crime thrillers that are sort of contemporary, they're coming from the Tarantino school of, you know, riffing on other movies, of having, you know, meta humor, of, you know, performing on multiple levels at once, which is not to say this movie doesn't, because I think it does. But it does so in a very different way from most contemporary crime thrillers. It is not really, it's not a plot-oriented movie. You know, if you think about, I mean, yes, things do happen quickly in succession in a plot-like manner. It feels plotted. But, you know, most crime thrillers, contemporary ones, I mean, you were just talking about Atomic Blonde, a movie that seems to, you know, rely on a MacGuffin and have, you know, a lot of characters and double crosses and triple crosses. This is not at all, it's not plotted like a contemporary crime thriller. It's not really, you know, there's a heist involved, but it's not a heist movie. There's prison involved, but it's not a prison break movie. It's very much, it thrives on chaos, and it thrives on the sort of improvisatory feel where the Robert Pattinson character, Nikas, really just gets into a series of continually worse and worse scrapes and sort of wriggles his way out of them in a way that feels very, very organic and not writerly and not sort of making nods at the audience, not sort of being above the fray in a way that most sort of contemporary crime films are. So it has a very different, sort of feel than what you might be used to. And it's very refreshing to have a crime thriller be so performance focused. And also, you mentioned this, Ricky, but the Safdies have this incredible proficiency with both professional and untrained actors. And on that note, it was a really big gambit for them to go with Pattinson for this, because besides, you know, a relatively brief set of appearances from Jennifer Jason Leigh, and also a brief appearance from Bakar Abdi, from best known for Captain Phillips, you know, this is really a cast full of, like, of unknowns and new people, including a pivotal role. Crystal is played by a young Talia Webster, who I really hope was not only 16 years old, for reasons that will be clear to people who see the movie. You know, they've got this great facility with actors, but so many of the faces are new and unknown. So the fact that the movie's anchored by this very familiar face could have been really a huge problem. And it's a testament to both the Safdies and Pattinson, who, you know, has really clearly, doing the Twilight movies, completely soured him on the Hollywood experience and or encouraged him to do just whatever the fuck he wants for the rest of his career, because he's done nothing but work with interesting directors on interesting projects, even if not all of them panned out, since then. And they clearly placed a lot of faith in him, and that faith was not misplaced, because he is fantastic in this film.
Yeah, I think, like, the whole movie zips forward at such an unnerving speed, like an unnerving pace, that it sort of mirrors the character, because his character never really stops to think. He's like a mess, and the movie's somewhat of a mess, and there's so much chaos. And I think, like, the editing coupled with the soundtrack, with the score, with the performances, like, everything about this movie, with even the cinematography, like, I mean, when we talk about Atomic Blonde being, you know, at times, like, beautiful to watch, it's a different kind of beautiful than Good Times. Like, Good Times is gritty and raw, and it's at times, like, a tough watch, but there's something beautiful in the ugliness. And so, like, they're working with this, like, amazing cinematographer named Sean Price Williams, and he just shoots the whole entire film with this, like, it's, I don't know how to explain it, but it has, like, this, like, hue of, like, pink and blue and black lights, and they sort of, like, position the characters in front of, like, a TV static glow. Like, it's hard to explain, but it feels like one of those, like, 70s New York crime thrillers, but just heightened a bit, like, in terms of, like, the colors and, like, the actual, like, lensing of the movie. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they actually did shoot in film. You know, they have this, like, one beautiful and it's like, I say the word beautiful, but it's also kind of messy, because it's so, like, chaotic. Like they have this like tracking shot. It's like a Steadicam that follows them after they rob the bank. And so it's moving at a really fast pace. And it's like, you know, it's a typical shaky cam that you see in like one of those Bourne movies. And at the Q&A, they actually said that they destroyed the camera because I think the cameraman had tripped, fallen, and he had broken the camera, which cost him like $200,000. Of course, they're insured. But the point is, like, they somehow got this amazing shot despite the fact that the cameraman actually screwed up, tripped, and broke the camera, and they still kept that same shot. They were like, the Q&A was really interesting. If you ever see these guys live, like, they are a riot. Like, they just like liven up the room. They're so interesting to listen to. They got so many stories to tell. They were saying that they actually wanted to shoot a different film. They wrote a script for an actual prison film. And they put that on hold, and they decided to make this movie. But you know the scenes, like, in the prison, when Robert Pattinson actually goes to the prison? That's, like, a real prison with real prison inmates. And he has to – he's walking around getting to know these people. What he said at the Q&A was that he didn't really know what to do in terms of, like, the performance until he went to visit the prison. And he said that once he had put on the clothes – and visited that prison and got to understand how these people talk and their lingo, et cetera, et cetera, he just somehow fell into the character. And from there, like, he just, like, knew exactly what he wanted to do in terms of, like, the performance. But what's interesting about this character, like, there was, like, this big sort of, like, debate at the Fantasia Film Festival because they were asking the actor, Robert Pattinson, and the directors if they think his character is, like, a psychopath or a sociopath. And one of them said yes, and one of them said no. And so they had different visions of what this character is like. And the interesting thing about his character, for me personally, is that I love the way they establish the bond between the siblings. And we don't really get to know what happened to them when they were younger, but it's sort of like implied that they were most likely abused. But that's the thing, like, just with the performances, you get to know so much about these characters and their backstory. But what I really like about his performance is there's something intriguing about him. Like, he's, like, at times repulsive, right? He's sleazy, but he's also just very capable and in control, and yet at the same time out of control. But he's also charismatic enough that he can get all of these people to help him out in his quest to free his brother from prison. So it's just really, really difficult performance to pull off.
I completely agree with what Rick just said. He's definitely a scumbag, but he's a scumbag you'd be interested in sitting at a bar and having a beer with just to hear some of his scummy tales.
I think that the way that the movie plays with having Pattinson in this role is really interesting. I think it's obviously, as I said, I think Pattinson is great. There's something about sort of having that movie starness, which, you know, he does have that star quality for this role that has a few interesting effects. Other people have already commented on this, and I think they're right to. The movie has an interesting kind of subtextual layer where, you know, even though it is dealing with these with this very sort of like scummy criminal element, and it's dealing with people on the lower rungs of society, there's still this real present element of privilege to his character. And of course, I'm speaking about, you know, white privilege, where he's just constantly getting away with things that a black person in his position would never, ever, ever be able to do. And I'm not only saying that because, you know, it's just, you know, a thing you can think about. I'm saying it because the movie constantly kind of sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly underlines this point. Like, it's notable that, you know, they pull off, or, you know, quote unquote, pull off this bank heist wearing these black masks, which they then pull off with some difficulty, it should be noted, you know, to reveal their white faces, at which point they can seemingly get away scot-free. There's a key and very, very difficult to watch sequence late in the movie involving Bakar Abdi, where Pattinson is able to just assume his position and, you know, pretend to be him while you know, the black character is just subjugated to this awful, awful treatment. And it's never, I'm not saying, the movie's not, you know, preachy about it or anything like that, but it is this very sort of uncomfortable, queasy undertone and subtext of the film that's really underlined by having a guy like Pattinson play that character where, you know, he gets away with, you know, we probably don't want to talk about where the movie ends up, but he gets away with a lot And some of it is charm and cunning and thinking on the spot, and some of it is just a function of what he looks like and how he carries himself. I just found that layer of the movie it was really natural and really queasy and unsettling, and the way it was folded into the fabric of the movie was super interesting.
Yeah, at the Q&A, the directors actually did comment on that specific scene, and the idea is that, yes, if it was a white man who played a security guard, then the cops wouldn't have been so quick to beat him up and arrest him, which is a fact, which I think is true. But also, like, the when you mentioned the bank robbery, like, I thought that scene was just, like, so surreal. Like, there was just something odd about it. Like, they put on these masks, and it's like in the film, they just, like, they like, and that's the thing about this character. Like, they walk into the bank, they don't have, like, a gun, they don't threaten to kill anyone, they're not violent, they don't actually ever try to hurt anyone. So, like, even though this character is sort of like a sleazeball, he's not the type of person who would actually hurt someone, at least not physically, right?
Well, not then anyway.
Not then, yeah. But, like, the thing is, like, that scene in the bank, like the bank robbery scene, I just thought there was something, like, so unique about it. Like, when they put on those masks and just the way it played out, like the fact that, you know, they were passing a note to the teller and the teller would pass a note back and forth. And
it's just very banal, right? It just feels like just another transaction at the bank. And, like, you know, unfortunately, they just get a little bit too greedy.
Well, it's also the first example of things going wrong for them too, because they weren't going away with the loot they anticipated either.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is that when the bank robbery ends, like, he congratulates his brother and says, like, I could not do it without you. And he's trying to boost up his self-esteem and try to, like, make him understand that he really needs him in his life. And I actually kind of believe him. Like, I think he's lost without him. And so that's why when he gets sent to prison, it's not just because they are related that he wants to, like, set him free. I think he actually believes that he needs him in his life. And there's this interesting scene at the end of the film when he's talking to a character who pops up midway through the film. And he basically tells the character, like, he tells this guy, he's like, I am better than you. Like, look at you. You're uneducated. You're lost. You come out of prison. You're an alcoholic. And he actually does think he's better than him. At the same time, he needs him. I mean, that's why he decides to partner up with him, because he's the type of person that can't be alone. Like, he always needs someone to need him in order to make himself feel like he has some importance in this world. And if it's not his brother, and he attaches himself to this teenage girl, if it's not her, he attaches himself to this guy named Ray, who, by the way, the character Ray is played by Buddy Duress, who was in the previous movie, Heaven Knows What. So he's in this movie too. And those two characters, the teenage girl, I can't remember the actress's name, but the character Ray played by Buddy Duress, they kind of, like, steal the show for not the entire film, but for, like, a good bit. They actually do steal the show.
It's Talia Webster, by the way.
Talia Webster, that's it. She's amazing in this movie. Like, I could not stop laughing. And what I found so interesting about this movie is this movie really is about his bond with his sibling, right? But yet he disappears because he gets thrown in prison. And then we follow around this character and all of these other characters who he interacts with within a period of, like, 24 hours. And it zips by so fast. Like, there's something really interesting about, like, the structure of this film. I think the best scene in this movie is when he goes to the bail bonds office. Jennifer Jason Leigh is in that scene, and that's an actual bail bonds man, right? That's legit. That's what that guy does. That's his actual office in New York City. That guy's for real. That's his wife sitting next to him, right? And so they shoot the scene, and the way it's framed, like, the way it's cut, the way it's shot, it's like, it's sort of like a Robert Altman scene, or I don't know, like, what's a TV show where everyone keeps on talking over each other, like The Good Wife or something?
Yeah, actually, that's a good example.
They're just talking over each other, and there's all of this stuff. Like, there's all of this stuff happening within that one scene. And all it basically is, it's like four people or four or five people sitting in a room, just yelling at each other, making phone calls, trying to negotiate. And there's just so much suspense and tension, urgency built in that one scene with just, like, four people standing around. Like, and the way he shot it and framed it and cut it, it's amazing.
Well, and that scene is a good example of their facility with not only their facility with non-actors, but their situational awareness of, like, hey, we're going to have a scene set in a bail bonds office. It's not only because they used a real bail bondsman and, you know, they used his office and all that. It's because they have the presence of mind to say, look, why don't we've got a guy here who has probably been in some variation of this circumstance hundreds of times. So honestly, the guy probably didn't need a ton of careful coaching to like know how to respond to the situation. Like when he's interjecting throughout the scene, being like, you know, you're being a real pain in the ass. Like this is not necessary. There's something like really beautifully natural about those interjections because you know that he's done this before, and you know it's having them having the confidence to just sort of lean on his presumably years of experience for that is, you know, just is. There's a common sense aspect that still you don't get very often.
Well, that's what I think makes the movie so special, because a lot of times they just sort of like use these quote unquote non-professional actors, and they're not really actors. They just basically cast someone in the role because they fit the role. For example, the dude who plays the cop, well, guess what? He's actually a cop in real life. You know what I mean? It's like almost everyone in this movie that plays a cop is a cop in real life. They do it in each and every single movie. You need a heroin addict? Let's actually get a heroin addict. Let's talk to this girl that we found in the middle of the street who's a druggie and cast her in our movie. And guess what? She's playing a heroin addict. Like for them, like they said that there's no such thing as like a bad actor. It's all about casting and making sure that person fits the role.
Mm-hmm. It's also, when we're talking about having these things folded in, again, sort of the risk of this movie is the fact that you have all these naturalistic elements, these non-actors folded in with these, with things like Robert Pattinson. And like, I mean, just the fact that, that Ben Safdie's playing a mentally handicapped character when he himself is not mentally handicapped. And that could have been, frankly, a total disaster, but, thankfully he's a good enough actor, and he, you know, all he really does is he limits his range of expression and you know, only to let it blossom at certain moments, like you said, like the single tear that happens to trickle down his face in that opening scene, which is a very sort of evocative moment. And, you know, people may complain about representation and, you know, why didn't they use an actual mentally handicapped person, which is a debate for another time. But I will say that his performance did not feel like any sort of, it didn't feel caricatured. It felt lived in, and it felt credible, which is really impressive.
Well, I think Pattinson just, he holds everything together. He's in nearly every shot of the movie,
yeah.
And he's just so good. The minute he walks onto the screen, you look at him, and there's no backstory. There's no exposition. You just look at him, and you know that guy. You've seen that guy before. You've walked down the streets and seen him, and you probably took a little bit of a wide step around him,
yeah,
just
you crossed
hoping
the
he
street.
Didn't ask you a question. Yeah, and so since he's in every scene and he's so good, you can bounce these people who've never acted before because they don't have to carry too much of the narrative load, right? So there's just enough of everybody surrounding him to, you know, give the film that sense of authenticity without it feeling amateur.
Yeah, it's not exactly a coincidence that you have the show Cops playing in one scene in the background. Like, his character is flipping through channels and they land on the channel that's playing the classic show Cops, which I think has been on air for like over 26 years, right? And so the directors believe, like they said this at the Q&A, they believe that is the greatest television show ever made because it captures this like ugly side of America, and it does it with such a rawness, and it's so real, and it's exploitive, yes, but it shows this ugly side of America, which is kind of important, like to address these issues. And so they kind of like wanted to put that specific scene in the movie because that's kind of like what they are trying to do. Like, this is fiction, but at the same time, they're showing a glimpse of New York City. Like, these stories of these people are not far away from the truth of people that they've actually met in real life. And I find it really interesting that the main character in his film believes he used to be a dog in his previous life. And when we're at the Q&A, it was funny because when we're at the Q&A, my friend Melissa commented on his performance, like specifically the director's performance, who plays the mentally handicapped sibling. And she's like, you kind of felt like sort of like a lost, abandoned, abused puppy that I picked up at a puppy mill. And like, I don't know, like Robert Pattinson kind of like looked at her and he, like, it was like this light went on over his head, and he didn't even register that his performance was exactly what she was describing. And he kind of felt like he just like done it without really thinking about it. Like, I don't know, explain it, but there is something really, really, really unique about these filmmakers. And I mean, I think that is why now like everyone in Hollywood is like looking their way. Like, they're sort of like in a spotlight right now. You know, they don't necessarily want to make Hollywood films, but you know, I think because Robert Pattinson decided that he wanted to be in one of their movies, they did finally get like an actual budget, like a huge budget to make this movie. I think Martin Scorsese backed them up. I think Sean Baker has been promoting their work for quite a while now. I actually watched the short film they made called The Black Balloon, which you can find on Vimeo and YouTube. It's fantastic. 20 minutes long. It's a this sort of like New York retelling of the Red Balloon. It's an interesting film. I also did, like I said, I did watch the Lenny Cook documentary because I'm a huge fan of basketball, and also the movie Daddy Long Legs, which is an interesting film. It's sort of like the, it's like a darkly comic tale of like a dysfunctional single dad who, you know, basically walks around New York City trying to help his children, but he keeps on screwing up all the time. So it's really interesting. I highly recommend it.
The we haven't mentioned one of the most important aspects of the movie, which is, of course, the score by Daniel Lopatin, a.k.a. 10tricks.never, who is a guy whose records I've been listening to for years and years. To my knowledge, at the very least, it's his first major sort of work as a film composer. And, you know, we've had no shortage of sort of retro synth scores, you know, over. In fact, if anything, it's been kind of a plague at this point, because it seems like every crime film, every horror film kind of has this like retro 8-bit, 16-bit or whatever analog synth score. But Lopatin brings an intensity and like a level of detail and craft that I think is well above most of those. And his score is like a major, major reason why the movie is as kinetic and propulsive and intense as it is.
Well, I think it's because
the score had me so pumped. I felt like I could dunk on a 20-foot net. That's how I got felt 5 minutes into the movie. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's because the soundtrack's melodies gives us a good idea of what it feels like to be inside Connie's head. There's just, it was composed specifically for the movie frame by frame. Like, the thing is, they originally were going to like add like a typical, a traditional soundtrack, and they just weren't happy with any music that was chosen. Like, they're like, you could put like my favorite song, you could put Elvis Presley, you could put, I don't know, you could put anybody. And it just wouldn't work. Like, it just, it kind of made, took away from the feeling that you were actually there in New York City following around these people. Cause they have like, it has this sort of like documentary feel to it. I also really, really, really love the scene when they go to Adventureland. Like, that scene, cause it's like, it's really creepy.
Well, I think what's really uncomfortable about the scenes in the sort of like a haunted house ride, in this.
There was also a sex dungeon, wasn't it?
Was it?
It looked like it.
It did look like it. Whatever it is, the thing that makes it so creepy is the fact that they don't find it creepy. Like, there's that was my favorite thing about that scene. Like, they're in there because they're looking for something, and that's their single-minded purpose. And so nothing about what's happening in this rather creepy like set of contraptions creeps them out at all, because they're so single-minded, but it is creeping us out, and it's a fun little bit of like cognitive dissonance that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, so I just got to ask you about the 16-year-old girl in this movie. Like, what did you think about the scene when he tries to sleep with her?
Oh, I mean, that was yet another, well, I mean, he tries to sleep with her. It's not really another thing that's sort of like squelchy and gross and weird and uncomfortable about this movie in a productive way. Is, you know, he really only hooks up with her to distract her from something else, right? So it's not really clear if he...
No, not really, because he starts to seduce her before Ray wakes up.
No, not that. He's distracting her from the news, because his face is on the news.
Right, yeah.
So it's not really clear whether he would cross that line, but I mean, based on everything else we know about him, it's clear that he doesn't give a fuck about lines. I mean, luckily the movie kind of stops him before things get too weird. But yeah, I'm not sure how old the actress actually is, but there's a clear age discrepancy between her and Robert Pattinson, and it is quite disquieting. But again, it's just another one of those things about this movie that is productively quite icky, let's say.
Yeah, I got one more question. What did you think of the scene when they're driving in a car and Ray starts telling the story about what happened to him after he came out of prison, and it turns into this like flashback? Because it's the one scene in the movie, and I liked the scene, but it kind of felt out of place.
It kind of reminded me of the Michael Pena scene in Ant-Man when he kept going on about his cousin. It felt like everything was so
it reminded me of the opening scene to The Rules of Attraction.
I don't think that was the opening scene in Rules of Attraction. The scene where he talks about his European vacation.
Oh right, okay. It wasn't the opening scene,
but I know what scene you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like a bit of a respite from the tension in the film, and like cut out for a second. That might be the only room you had to sit and catch your breath before things ramped up again.
I think that's the one scene. I think I can understand why it stood out for you in maybe a less than perfect way, Ricky, because like on its own, it's a good scene, but it's the one aspect that, yeah, it does pull you out. And also it feels, you know how I opened this review by talking about the crime movies that this doesn't feel like, where it's not giving you a wink and a nod. It's not throwing in sort of clever formal tricks. And that felt like the one part of the movie where they were throwing in kind of a clever formal trick or a sort of something a little bit flashier to distract you, which, you know, I think in context, like you were saying, Victor, it does work as a breather, but it does feel like it doesn't have it breaks the formal discipline a bit, I guess I would say.
Well, we spent so much time, you know, right in Pattinson's orbit. That's the first time you kind of break away and see someone else's perspective, true, yeah, aside from the very beginning of the film.
Yep.
I guess since we're wrapping up, the last thing I wanted to talk about without getting into spoiler territory is the impact of that final scene, the scene over which the end credits play. And I thought that was a brilliant move, frankly, because it's I thought, you know, the film was going to wrap up in a certain way. But then to have it end on this rather tranquil sequence involving the brother who's incarcerated, I thought was a really smart move and a way to really throw everything that that Nikas was doing into sharp relief, because it really underlines like you were saying, Ricky, that his codependency is really it's not about, you know, true, he thinks it's earnest interest in, you know, being his brother's keeper. But clearly he has no capacity to really look out for anyone's best interests, even his own. And I think the way that the final scene really underlines that was really, really clever.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this sort of movie done a million times prior, but it's usually with a couple. It's like a man and a woman, Bonnie and Clyde types, right? True romance. Here, it's like two siblings. And that's the thing, like the relationship is toxic and you need to separate those two people in order for them to actually live their lives and move forward in a positive way.
So, yeah. That's good time. Is there anything else that deserves mention before we wrap things up?
Go see it on a big screen in a crowded theater.
Hell yeah. I was a little bit sad that I saw it in a mostly empty theater. I would have loved to have had the full Fantasia experience for that one. One more thing I wanted to mention about how this differs from other recent crime thrillers movies like this. It's not very violent. I think it's notable. Like, I mean, there's a couple of scenes of like notable impactful violence, but it's really restrained. Like, it's not sort of over the top you know, shoot 'em up blood fest or, you know, intense beatings every other scene. It's the Safdies are really restrained in their use of violence, and that actually makes it more impactful when it does happen, and I really appreciated that. Anyway, just wanted to get that in there. So that's about it for us. Victor, are you on Twitter?
At Victor J. Stiff.
Fantastic. I'm on there at Hollow Minds. Ricky, you run the Sorted Cinema Twitter, yes?
No, Patrick runs Sorted Cinema.
I always get confused about that.
My Twitter handle is GoombaStompMag. You can also follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, Pinterest, Instagram, you name it. And yeah, please give us a rating on iTunes if you do like our show. It would be much appreciated.
Fantastic. All right, go out there and see Good Time. Maybe go see Atomic Blonde. And we'll be back in roughly a week's time to talk more shit. Have a great day, everyone.